Hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley coming at you with episode 74 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. We are here to talk about two films that recently came up on the Criterion channel, both of them, of course, dating from 1971. And they have a lot in common, actually, which is why I'm kind of doing this as a double feature night, if you will. We're going to be talking about Sidney Lumet's The Anderson Tapes and Richard Brooks's Dollars. With me tonight, just to kind of get into this little exercise in genre and thriller action heist flicks, is Richard Doyle. Richard, thank you for joining me once again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Excellent. Well, yeah, this is kind of a fun diversion, I would say, given where I often find myself feeling a little bit of a burden of even responsibility, if you will, covering some of the great and artistically challenging films of this era. Here, I think these are quality films, but I don't know that they're especially deep or profound. And I kind of like the idea that we're just going to talk about a couple of, what I consider pretty entertaining films, each of which give us plenty of interesting stuff to talk about. So, Richard, thanks for jumping in with me on this. This kind of came up on rather short notice. These films just came up in March, and here we are on March 25th, almost to the end of the month. I think these films will probably both be around for a while, and I guess their excuse or the premise for their bundling in the Criterion channel is that they're part of a large package of soundtracks by Quincy Jones. So that's just one of the elements that this thing has in common, that these two films link that together. But there's a lot more to it than that. So, I don't know. What do you want to say about these films, maybe just as a pairing, just to get started? And we'll start breaking them down one by one in a few minutes.
Obviously, they're both heist films. I think they're both heist films with interesting twists to them, not the same kind of twist. I think the subtext that Lumet tries to bring to the Anderson tapes is interesting, whereas the nature of the heist is what's always made Dollars stand out to me. It's probably one of the better films like that.
Yeah.
They're both directors who I think this is, for each of them, this is the film that introduces them to the 1970s, not just by the fact that it's 1971, but it's a sort of shift in style for each of them.
Yeah, that's a great observation. Yeah, Sidney Lumet and Richard Brooks both have, some pretty serious credentials to their name. They are both featured in the Criterion Collection. Sidney Lumet with 12 Angry Men, and more recently released Failsafe. The Fugitive Kind was also reissued. I guess The Fugitive Kind and Failsafe kind of came out pretty close together. Fugitive Kind being kind of an upgrade from the old DVD-only release. And then Richard Brooks, I guess his only Criterion entry at this point is In Cold Blood. Am I correct in that? I think I did my homework.
Yeah.
That's what I recall. Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I think there's been rumors of Elmer Gantry, but otherwise right now it's just In Cold Blood.
Yeah. Elmer Gantry is available on the Criterion channel, as is Blackboard Jungle, which was part of the Sidney Poitier package. We talked about that with Brother John a while back. But that was, I think, Brooks's big breakthrough as a director. And maybe we'll get into analyzing him a little bit more. They also have pretty interesting casts of leading men, Warren Beatty in Dollars, Sean Connery in the Anderson Tapes, kind of vivacious blondie female leads with Diane Cannon in the Anderson Tapes, Goldie Hawn in Dollars. So, yeah, there are some interesting through lines, but I'm intrigued by this thought that you raise here about this is their introduction to the 70s. I think both directors are on a bit of a lark here. They're not necessarily making the big, statement type of films. They both have kind of a progressive political attitude about them, and the social conscience on Brooks and Lumet I'm talking about. But here, I think, while they're making some statements about, culture, society, etc., these are not real obvious message movies. They're getting into a little bit of the freedom that 70s cinema was allowing in terms of frankness, adult-oriented content, etc. sexuality, you know, all of those kind of more candid things that Hollywood cinema just wasn't allowing up until, you know, just a few years before these films were released. Why don't you expand on that thought a little bit about these directors, your experience with them, and how you see them transitioning to kind of a new era in filmmaking?
For Lumet, he was, like, for both of them, actually, their reputation in the 60s was more or less a kind of gritty realism. Mm-hmm. Lumet a bit more than Brooks, but I think one of the biggest things you see in both of these films is that they're stylistically very different from what they'd been doing in the 60s. They're a little bit flashier, and the editing is a little bit looser, especially on Anderson tapes with its sort of odd flashback structure to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think there's like one of the things that really sort of marks both of them as sort of a move into the 70s is they're both quite cynical films.
Yeah.
Which is not what either guy was known for up until then. I mean, there's a slight edge of cynicism to Failsafe, but mostly, you know, they were doing fairly idealistic films, and this is certainly, neither of these is very idealistic in that sense. Both a little amoral.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I watched Failsafe just the other night just to kind of, you know, get a little bit deeper into Lumet's career and some of his more notable work, and, you know, to divert into Failsafe just a moment. I mean, yeah, there is a slightly cynical tone, as you say, but you compare that to Dr. Strangelove, which is kind of its, you know, companion piece, if you will. Well, the depths of cynicism and absurdity there are just unfathomable. And then Failsafe, of course, comes across as pretty uptight and even a little bit self-righteous in its seriousness and its sense of its own importance. You're right here. There's a just kind of a, you know, nihilism is probably overstating the case, but it's kind of a, you know, dog eat dog, each man for its own, and you know, get while the getting's good is kind of the prevailing attitude here. So let's start our conversation with the Anderson tapes. This was a film released in June of 1971. So, and according to my strict chronology, we're jumping backwards a little bit. You and I and a few others just kind of finished a few days ago talking about the Last Picture Show, which was an October release, but because I kind of make some allowances for these Criterion Channel one-offs, we're going to jump backwards in my timeline here. And The Dollars is actually a December release. We'll get to that one in a little bit. But, you know, you want to give us a little walk-in intro to the Anderson tapes, especially for listeners who maybe listen to the episode before they even watch the film. What are we getting at here?
Sure. It stars Sean Connery, who had a prior working relationship with Lumet on a movie, The Hill, which was Connery's sort of big attempt to get away from the James Bond image. It's a military prison movie, and it's actually a very good film. So in this, he plays the titular Anderson, who's a career criminal who gets out of jail at the beginning of the film with a very young Christopher Walken, all of like maybe 19 years old in this, and an elderly man.
Pop, yeah.
And right. He moves back in with his prior girlfriend, Diane Cannon, and hatches a plan to rob the apartment building she lives in because everybody who lives in it is fairly wealthy.
And she lives in a very fashionable, a very luxury condominium or apartments, I guess. You know, it's very high rent district. One of the reviews I saw kind of got into a little bit of the detail of this particular building, the Conn Mansion or something like that. So apparently it's got some historic significance. And if you're into old New York architecture or just kind of high-end real estate in general, this film is a bit of a travelogue inside the interiors of that building. So there must have been some interesting negotiations that went on to get into this particular, you know, complex of residencies, because they kind of tear the place up a little bit too, yeah, in the process. So that's a pretty fascinating sub theme here. But yeah, she's living there. He knocks on the door with that immortal reunion line, "I haven't been laid in 10 years," and then off they go. But yeah, it's, to me, this seemed in some ways like sort of a male fantasy, as a kind of a, you know, a guy who's done 10 years of hard time. I also enjoyed that little opening segment there where he's being kind of, you know, he's been interviewed, recorded on videotape, and it's part of a group therapy session where I guess that's some effort at rehabilitation of prisoners, you know, kind of getting them to check out their own morals, do their own little personal inventory of what motivates them to commit crimes. it's a bit of a farcical exercise. It even tapped into some of that 70s group therapy encounter self-realization thing that was going on at the time as well.
That sort of introduces, I think, one of the major subtexts in this film, which is the fact that the sort of a Watergate era subtext that everything in this film is being recorded by somebody. There's a videotaping going on as Diane Cannon's apartment is being tape recorded by a private detective. So that's sort of the running theme of the film. It's why it's called the Anderson Tapes, and I think it's one of the more interesting things about the film.
Yeah, this whole era of surveillance technology, wires and video cameras popping up everywhere. There's kind of these little sound effects, this little beeps and bloops and buzzes that occur throughout the film that, you know, in some ways I think really date it quite a bit. I find it pretty charming and pretty amusing myself because you recognize that this is right at the time that the Moog synthesizer and electronic sounds of this sort were really just kind of a cutting edge of audio technology. And so the composer, Quincy Jones, already been referenced at the beginning here, he was playing with it like a lot of other, you know, musicians were at the time. You know, you had, you know, bands like Yes and even the Beatles, you know, used the Moog on Abbey Road. And of course, the Krautrock, the progressive musicians, Popol Vuh and others were experimenting with these sounds. And Wendy Carlos, etc. You know, here you just get some of this novelty of these, you know, kind of buzzing sounds that are kind of indicative of the fact that we're kind of in this new era, because now you can make very small microphones and hide them pretty easily and kind of get the inside scoop of what's going on in heretofore private spaces. And with the prevalence of this kind of eavesdropping, just like we saw when the internet first kind of came in, there's this little sort of paranoid reaction about who's listening and what are they finding out and how do we adjust to this new reality where our privacy isn't what it used to be. So, you know, in an era where we talk about and think about our own privacy and the gathering of data by, you know, big companies that track our every movement, you could say this is sort of a beginning of the age that we're living in now. And I do agree, that's a very fascinating aspect of this film. As you see multiple parties getting in on this gimmick of just dipping in to hear what people are saying when they think nobody else is listening.
Yeah, and sort of the running joke of the film is that nobody who manages to record all of the planning of this heist is interested in the heist.
So they're all snooping for their own reasons, right?
Yeah, so the entire plan is sort of laid out to various parts of law enforcement, and none of them realize what they're listening to, essentially.
Right, because they're not really in coordination with each other. They're all running their own independent operations, which is, you know, both kind of charming and bumbling at the same time. And it is kind of amusing because they're kind of all kind of chasing each other around the tree while Sean Connery, Anderson, Duke Anderson, the titular character, is kind of getting a gang together. And, you know, the caper itself is, I guess, the premise is that he just wants to, you know, score that big job because he wants to get free from all the ties and debts and obligations of his old way of life, and his ideal is to become a sponge fisherman.
Yeah,
that was pretty funny. But he, you know, the two other men that he is released with after they've all served their time, Pop is the elder gentleman, Christopher Walken. I think his only name in the movie is the kid, right? He doesn't have any other name than that. And he's a kind of a drug dealer, so presumably hasn't done a lot of time. He's still young, nonviolent offender. Pop, the old guy, he was a murderer. He killed somebody, so he's done hard time, 40 years or whatever, and since before the Depression. There's some pretty interesting lines there as well. And then he connects with some old mobsters, one guy in particular played by Alan King, who's kind of risen to higher levels of prominence since the days when he and Duke used to kick around as low-level thugs. But Duke's got this reputation as an expert safe cracker, and Duke goes about casing the joint and in the process recruits a few other people, including Martin Balsam, who's a great actor, a great character actor, but there's some, I guess I'll just say, some troubling aspects, especially for viewers maybe younger, more used to seeing the LGBT community portrayed in less offensive stereotypes. But what would you think about Martin Balsam's character here?
Well, I mean, I'll give it this. There are films in the similar era like Vanishing Point and Mean Streets that have small appearances by gay characters where I think they're sort of actively mean-spirited. And I didn't get that from the film.
Yeah.
I think it's just a mistake.
it's a very common depiction, a very swishy, pansy type of character. He's an art collector, interior decorator. I mean, all the cliches kind of rolled into one there.
Yeah, it's meant for, as comic relief, I gather, and everybody in the movie comments on it almost without fail. Mm-hmm. I think it's actually one of the strange plot holes in the movie, in that he's used to case the apartment, and then he's along with on the heist as if anybody wouldn't recognize him immediately.
Yeah, he's right. His physique, his voice,
his wig.
I mean, all of that.
Yeah,
it doesn't really add up. But he's part of the crew here, and they go about kind of plotting it out, and really that's kind of where the movie goes. It's just kind of a, you get into the characters, you get to know them as quirky individuals, each with their own role, and then you see what they do to actually pull off and orchestrate the heist itself. So what are some other elements that stood out to you or drew you into the mechanics of what we see going on here?
I should also bring up Socks, the mafia.
Oh yeah,
guy.
Yeah.
They have to take along as part of their mob financing, and the idea is that Sean Connery has to kill him during the heist.
Yeah, he's this kind of sadistic hitman who's become more of a problem to the mob, but they want to sort of get rid of him. He's kind of outlived his functionality, so they get him in the gang, and you get into some racial stuff as well, because Duke recruits a black guy to be a driver, I guess, and also just to kind of get into that community. And Sox doesn't really feel comfortable around those people.
That leads to the most 1971 moment in the film, I think, which is when Duke tells the other people that he has to, that part of the deal is that he has to kill Sox, and Christopher mm-hmm. Walken says something along the lines of, "Hey man, violence. If that's your bag, okay, but it's not mine, but if that's what you want to do, okay."
Yeah, Mr. Groovy, yeah. Trippy, hippie dude over here. Yeah. What about the whole Diane Cannon, Sean Connery bit? I mean, to me, that felt like a lot of just, marketing kind of, we're very used at this point to seeing Sean Connery bedding another beautiful woman. And I guess that was Diane Cannon's turn. I don't think she was ever in any James Bond movies, but those bedroom scenes they had together really felt pretty much like a James Bond type of encounter along those lines.
Yeah. She would have been pretty hot at this point, coming off Bob and Ted and Carolyn Ellis.
Oh, yeah. She was definitely a happening thing, and I think they lend a nice kind of star attraction. I mean, I don't know that her character is anything all that profound. I think she, again, is kind of a male fantasy figure. I mean, here's a guy who's been in jail for 10 years, and he just shows up, rings the doorbell, and she's like, make love to me. And yeah. Just like, yeah, just she's just ready to go. Her status in the film, she's a bit of a kept woman. She's living in this very high rent apartment because she's willing to give Thursdays to this guy who's basically paying all her bills. And yeah. You know, he kind of comes back with a vengeance later on and kind of you know, puts her loyalty to the test and uses his own leverage over her and his wealth to kind of, you know, turn the screws on Duke as well. So, you know, there's little, you know, bits of character and rivalry and all of that. I'm not sure that it amounts to a whole lot as far as the real interpersonal dynamics. To me, it's more just setting up the premise and then seeing how it all unfolds and unravels, which, as most heist films go, it doesn't go according to plan.
No, I thought the drama with her boyfriend blackmailing him was really kind of an excuse to just get her to exit the film at that point when she wasn't needed anymore. She's definitely a male fantasy character because she happens to be the call girl that likes him more than her clients.
Yeah. That's kind of sums it right up there. Yeah, and right, and once they've had their, you know, kind of moments of very soft core erotica, I mean, it's pretty tame, actually. Yeah, she's kind of served her function, you know, and she moves on. What do you think about this as a piece for Sean Connery to step out of the James Bond mold? Do you think this was a successful branching out for him?
I don't think it would have. Well, he was temporarily out of Bond when he made this because he goes back to Diamonds Are Forever, but I believe that would be later this year, like after this film. And he was on a cold streak, I think, because the Molly Maguires, which is what he would have been right before this, was not a successful film. Mm-hmm. He certainly gets to be more hard-boiled, sort of a less of a glossy kind of figure in this, but I don't really think of this as like one of his ace roles.
No, I think he was still finding his way, you know, and I think, you know, he certainly went on to have a pretty notable post-Bond career, but this was a kind of a stepping out, and without having to, you know, completely transform himself, he's still playing, I think, to a James Bondish audience, you know. He's not necessarily an assassin, and he's, you know, trying to get by a little bit more on his wits and his nerve, and it's just kind of the bravado of you know, planning this big heist and seeing how far he can take it. I read somewhere that the original ending that Lumet had in mind was actually for him to escape and get away with it, but the conventional thinking was, well, that won't play well on TV because I guess they had aspirations to make this a, you know, TV feature film after it had completed its theatrical run, and you can't have wicked deeds go unpunished. So he does end up, you know, paying the price at the end there. Yeah, so do we want to talk about the heist at all? I mean, I think it's even if we spoil it a little bit for people who haven't watched it, I think it's still kind of fun and interesting to see how it all comes together and subsequently falls apart.
Yeah, I like the way they structured that part of the movie. It's one of the things that I saw this movie years and years ago, and I've always remembered it slightly fondly. And part of it, I think, is the way it intercuts the heist with the people who've been robbed talking to the police and served as a flashback structure to that heist.
Yeah, really. The bulk of the movie, if you go with that, is that we already learned pretty much from those little intercuts of the witnesses that the plan did not succeed. But yeah, we're kind of, you know, it kind of cuts back and forth. So there's some interesting narrative stuff going on there for sure.
Yeah. I also think the second big sort of gaping hole in their plan is that they leave Diane Cannon's apartment untouched, because apparently the police will never think that that's odd.
Yeah, well, and she's got some pretty nice merchandise in there as well. I mean, all of these apartments are very nicely appointed. And what is it that drives him to want to just clean this place out? It just seems to be a little bit of a mischievous streak. You know, he's just like, well, he's got an inn. He's got this girlfriend that he can stay with. So he'll hang out with her, case the joint, get his crew together, and then just rip them off. I mean, it's not like there's a particularly strong motive. He doesn't have any reason to get at these people. And the belongings, I guess there's the coin collection, there's some artworks. I don't know, it just feels like things really go haywire pretty quickly, and that this really wasn't, you know, I'm thinking of even some like the Melville heist films where, you know, there's a very objective treasure of some sort that they're after and very precise calculations and why they're getting it, what they're going in to do, how they're going to get away with it is all pretty well thought out. But then that one proverbial thing goes wrong and they have to adjust on the fly. This feels like it was kind of a messy operation from the get-go, but he's just doing it anyways.
Yeah, there are two things about it. I think kind of also mark it as a little bit of a transition to the 70s, because 60s heist films always tend to focus on master thieves doing extremely, you know, big heists, where this is 70s crime films tend to focus a little bit more on working class crime. And this is definitely the case in this. Like, he doesn't even, Christopher Walken is brought along to open up safes and things, and he's not even particularly all that talented at it. He's just better than anyone else on the crew, so he does a lot of crude things to bust things open. And I also think there's a couple of like really cruel ironies in this, that one, they're undone by the kid who has asthma and is in that air-conditioned room by himself, whose coin collection they take. They just casually leave him in there, which makes sense, but they don't even check out what he's got in the room, so he undoes them with a ham radio.
Yeah, and all again, more of this kind of relatively new technology, or at least the idea that a kid would have access to this kind of worldwide shortwave network, and that's how he contacts the police, and that's how the whole job is thwarted. You get an interesting little early in the career appearance by Garrett Morris, leader of Saturday Night Live fame, as one of the cops who's part of the kind of the immediate intervention team that, you know, lands on the roof. Some pretty cool streetscapes, and again, just kind of New York City architecture. The address of this place is right on Central Park, so you get some cool perspectives from up above the building and all of that. And then, you know, of course, the big finale there with everything, you know, kind of spiraling it into violence and brutality, the failed escape attempt, you know, they back up the Mayflower van, they bust out the back with a little minivan hidden in there, but everything just kind of completely spirals, you know, into disaster, and that pretty much wraps up the film. Was Duke actually dead, or just he was wounded, and I think in captivity at the end there? I think they have him sort of stood up on a stretcher there,
yeah,
kind of a little bit semi-conscious, and that's pretty much where things wind up there.
Yeah.
This movie was based on a pretty best-selling book, apparently. Was it Lawrence Patterson? Is that his name? Or no, Lawrence Sanders. He went on to have a pretty significant career, like the first and second and third Deadly Sins and all of that. And the character Iron Balls Delaney was kind of the lead cop, and that's Ralph Meeker has played. You know, so there's some great casting here. Ralph Meeker, of course, I think of him mostly as Stanley Kubrick and Paths of Glory alongside Kirk Douglas there. Pretty important role there. What else does he do?
Oh, the Kiss Me Deadly.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, of course. Right. So, yeah. So Ralph Meeker, this is a little bit later on in his career, obviously, but, and I wouldn't say he was a major figure here, but apparently, I mean, have you ever read any of those novels, Richard? I know you might be a little bit more into that stuff than I am.
No, I haven't in this case. I didn't realize he had another career outside of this one.
Yeah, so this was a best-selling book of the time, which may be one of the reasons that Sidney Lumet latched onto it as a project. One of the posters that I've put up online has a picture of the book in one of the lower corners. So obviously appealing to viewers of the time, like here's the big bestseller brought to the screen with this, you know, pretty interesting and unique cast. It is fascinating to me to see Christopher Walken with a big old head of shaggy hair. I've never seen or thought of him in that kind of visual presentation before. But and I think this was pretty much his first significant role.
Yeah, it certainly was. And he doesn't really do much until he shows up in Annie Hall and then The Deer Hunter, like at the end of the decade.
Right. Yeah, I don't know if he was doing theater or how he was hanging on, but it's still pretty cool. I mean, Christopher Walken's one of those great character actors of the last 30-40 years, and this is kind of where he first stepped out there. What do you think? I mean, I kind of already threw my theory out that this was just kind of a good bestseller, maybe a little bit of a meaty property for Sidney Lumet to say, yeah, I'll take this one on. But you're right. This is not typically what you think of as a Sidney Lumet film. Although, I guess if you look at things like Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, and Network, this could be sort of a transition to those types of movies. What are your thoughts along that line?
Yeah, that's how I would read it. I think he doesn't look to me like he was in a particularly successful phase of his career. He's made a series of films at this point that nobody ever speaks of, like The Seagull and Bye Bye Braverman, right? I think tackling a best-selling novel would definitely, with a big box office star, would definitely seem like a good move at this point. And I think it is sort of it's I wouldn't exactly call it gritty, but it's a fairly realistic crime film and seems to be like leading into it the kind of things he does in the 70s, with a few exceptions. He works with Connery again right after this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what did he do after that?
The Offense. It's not a very well-known mm-hmm. film, but it's a British police film that's actually mm-hmm. very good and one of Connery's best performances.
Yeah, I think Lumet was kind of one of these one-movie-a-year guys for quite a while, actually. He was pretty prolific. I think he directed over 50 titles over the course of his career. So he was, you know, absolutely a director for hire, not really an auteurist by any means. But he certainly has a very impressive roster of titles that, bear his name as the director. So for my interest, it's very cool to sort of see what he was doing in this little middle phase. I mean, some of the films that we've already referenced are pretty important works, however you want to attribute credit for what made him so great. But Sidney Lumet was certainly attached to a lot of those. And, to me, this is a fun exercise. It was kind of a cool little glimpse of what a lot of interesting character actors and others were doing. And, even though the Quincy Jones soundtrack does get its share of derision by certain commentators online because of the kind of jarring sound effects and kind of the gimmicks and quirkiness of it all, I like that stuff. To me, it's a very charming bit of period piece here.
Yeah,
did release a soundtrack album from the Anderson tapes, but you can find the theme on Smackwater Jack, one of his albums from 1971. So it is available, along with the Ironside theme and some other great tunes of that era.
Yeah, I like it quite a bit. I think it's really it's interesting work. I think he's kind of testing out a few things that Herbie Hancock was doing in the same time. And it's not exactly groundbreaking avant-garde jazz, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and it's not really an avenue that he pursued quite a bit. I think he went to more, conventional jazz compositions and stuff, and he was fantastic. And we can certainly talk a little bit more about Quincy's soundtrack for the next film. You ready to switch over to dollars, or anything else you want to say about Anderson tapes?
The only one thing I'd say about the Anderson tapes is I wonder if Stephen King likes this movie, because as I was watching it this time, there's more than one element in it that reminded me of The Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, tell us about that. Yeah, I didn't draw that association at all, but I've probably only seen The Shawshank twice over the years, and it's been quite a while since then. Yeah, tell me about that.
The old man who has been in prison his entire life and doesn't want to be in the regular world just sort of leaps out as, heck, that seems like an element that got resurrected in The Shawshank Redemption.
Sure, sure, I can see that, yeah.
And also the opening, somewhat about the talking about his criminal past and his feelings about it reminds me of some aspects of Morgan Freeman's character in The Shawshank Redemption. It just felt awfully similar.
Yeah. In some way. Yeah, yeah, these career criminals, these guys who are just kind of dyed in the wool, and they can never really be anything other than who they are, and yet, you know, the world somehow is expected to absorb them, and they're expected to, you know, adjust themselves to live in the end straight terms, and it just doesn't work at a certain point. It's an interesting concept, and I think, again, a certain form of escapism, maybe. You know, some men who've lived that life can relate to it more directly than I can. To me, it feels like, what if I just, you know, didn't give a damn and let myself go and live the criminal life? That's not how I actually live. But it's kind of fun to step into those roles or those shoes for an hour and a half and, you know, see where the story takes you. Mm-hmm. So let's go ahead and see where Dollars takes us, which is the Richard Brooks film starring Warren Beatty, Goldie Hawn, and Gert Frobe, who's an interesting, I'm not sure what else he's done. His face seemed familiar.
Goldfinger.
Goldfinger. Yeah, that was Goldfinger. Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. As I was thinking about it, yeah, that's who he looks like. So, of course. Now, did he have a pretty extensive career outside of that incredibly iconic role there? Did he do lots of other stuff?
He's done quite a bit of stuff in Germany. I know he's in The Testament of Dr. Mabuse, the first return to Dr. Mabuse that Fritz Lang made in Germany.
Oh, really? He's in that one from the 1930s, like 33 or whatever.
No, right? His return in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
The Testament. Okay. I said The Testament. I'm sorry. I meant The Thousand Eyes of Dr. Mabuse.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. I was going to say, boy, he must have been a child actor.
I got the wrong title there.
But yeah, he definitely brings some, and you know, and this is a film set in Hamburg, so even though you've got Warren Beatty and Goldie Hawn, almost the quintessential L.A., you know, male-female leads of this era, Richard Brooks has maybe slightly implausibly located them in Hamburg, right there on the Reeperbahn in the Red Light District. Warren Beatty, the head of security for this, you know, very august financial institution. And we first meet his characters. He's kind of walking the executives through all of the security measures that he apparently had a hand in implementing. You know, thick bulletproof glass, automated alarm systems, again, video cameras and surveillance mechanisms. You know, all that technology, once again, kind of playing itself out here as audiences are settling into this new reality. And a very foolproof, ultra-secure vault where everything is good and secure and safe. And, your first impression is that he's just this slick, technically competent American who's kind of coming in to show these Germans the latest and greatest and security, you know, apparatus and technology. As the movie unfolds, you realize he's, you know, kind of an ultimate inside man who's setting up this very masterfully schemed and ultimately executed caper. And to me, yeah, this is a very engaging movie. I really found this very enjoyable because of the character dynamics. We can talk about Warren, we can talk about Goldie, we can talk about Gert, but even the supporting characters, none of whose names really stand out to me all that much, but I'm pretty amused by the different types that are pulled in to serve as the patsies, if you will, the victims of this high-tech robbery that Warren Beatty and Goldie Hawn have concocted. What are your thoughts, just to kind of get us going on dollars?
This is a film I saw many years ago on television, and it stuck with me ever since, largely because I think it's one of the cleverest heists you'll see. And it's
it really is. It's quite nicely executed.
And mostly because he's targeting these shady people who can't report that they've been robbed.
It's kind of like he's been kind of eyeballing during his tenure working with the bank, you know, who are some of the shady dealers that are out there who are using the, you know, very confidential, very discreet, no questions asked security boxes for illicit purposes. And this is where I do believe we get a little bit of Richard Brooks's politics or his social perspective involved here. And before we go further, let's just talk a little bit about Richard Brooks. He's a very colorful character. He may not be a big name for a lot of cinephiles these days, but he is a big personality. What's your thought about Richard Brooks? Have you done much reading of his life and times or his interviews, any of that kind of thing?
Just a little bit. I find it interesting. He's someone who came into film directing via screenwriting. Mm-hmm. He was very big in the 60s. After Blackboard Jungle, he really has a string of fairly successful films in the 60s. Elmer Gantry and The Professionals and the adaptation of Lord Jim and Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. So he's fairly big in this era.
He also did some independent type of work. In Cold Blood was probably one of his supreme achievements. He also did Looking for Mr. Goodbar later in the 70s, which I think is one of those titles that a lot of people, well, maybe not a lot, but there's a certain group out there that's clamoring for that because it's really hard to find, almost like unavailable for whatever reason. But I think
it's the soundtrack.
Is it the soundtrack and the rights? Is that's what's hanging it up?
Yeah. It's one of these films in the 70s that uses a lot of popular music in the soundtrack, and it's made the rights to the movie prohibitively expensive. So it's been notably absent for a long time. And it's really early work for Richard Gere and a starring role for Diane Keaton. So it's been really sought after. And it's really the one really good film he makes after Dollars.
But, you know, like I say, his personality and he's very kind of cantankerous, kind of from that kind of John Huston mold, if you will, kind of sometimes a bit of a brawler and certainly verbally very cantankerous and blunt and all of that. So, yeah, he comes out of screenwriting. He's very much he was not, born into Hollywood royalty by any means. He just kind of scratched and clawed his way into this situation and I think made the most of his opportunity. But he has this kind of streak of populism and advocacy for the ordinary working guy. That's what I picked up in some of my reading about him as a director. And even his role as the director of In Cold Blood. Truman Capote tells an anecdote about how during a time where I think John Huston was verbally berating a lot of people in his inimitable style, just kind of being the jerk that he could be at times, Richard Brooks kind of stood there and took it and didn't get fazed by Huston's verbal antics and challenges. And that impressed Capote to the point he says, "You're the guy I want to direct this film," because he really liked the way Brooks kind of, held his metal and stood up to it. So interesting character there. And again, very well known in the Hollywood community that he lived and worked in. So here you've got a guy, Warren Beatty, who's certainly a pretty boy, kind of a matinee idol, a sex symbol, all of those things rolled into one, who's got this somewhat righteous scheme. He's going to deprive these dirty dealers of the gains that they've made through their various enterprises. And so you've got Las Vegas, which is a pair of guys who are basically just kind of laundering money. I mean, they're just, what is the source of their revenues? Do you recall right offhand? I know they're just, they have a big drawer full of cash.
I assumed it was mob because they said Las Vegas.
Right. So it's basically, they're just kind of you know, skimming money off the top, and every few weeks or so they'll drop another bundle of $10,000 or $20,000 into this big safe deposit box. And then there's the Army, which is an Army, I think he's a, you know, corporal or sergeant or whatever, but he's somebody with a bit of a rank in the armed services, and his deal is smuggling heroin that's packed inside of baseballs. So he's
it's a little more complicated. He's getting money from kickbacks from people that he's doing. I think he's a supply.
Yeah, right. You're right. He's obviously the convoy of goods. You know, he's sitting there checking off. But he's taking dirty deals on the side, along with this heroin smuggling thing that he's got going on, right?
Yeah, and that's that heroin smuggling. I don't think Beatty knows about it, and that's what does them in, essentially, because it connects him to the third person, the scary German man.
Yeah, the guy with the sunglasses who's dealing both in drugs and LSD, which was very interesting to me. I don't think of LSD as this big cash crop type of drug smuggling operation, but maybe in the 70s it was a different deal back then, you know.
I have a suspicion that this film's conception of LSD is a little inaccurate.
yeah, we can explore that as a little bit as we go on, because it certainly plays a significant role in the conclusion. But yeah, so the LSD is in liquid form, kind of smuggled as a couple of champagne bottles to get it through customs. So we've got these three kind of villainish type of characters, all of which I think most audiences would say, yeah, they deserve to be ripped off. And that's pretty much what Warren Beatty's setting up as the story unfolds. Goldie Hawn, what about her character? She's a proverbial, you know, another hooker with a heart of gold, kind of playing a little bit of that character that Diane Cannon epitomized, the whore who loves her fellow more than the customers that she does business with. Sort of like we talked about the swishy character in the Anderson tapes, there are probably some people who would take a little bit of offense or find Goldie Hawn's character a bit grating in her manic pixie dream girlishness. What did you think about Goldie Hawn in this particular role here?
I don't particularly like her in this movie, and I feel free to say so because apparently she felt the same way.
Yeah, some of her lines are pretty grating, you know, as far as equating sex with money, and just the way she kind of overplayed it with batting her eyes and her dopey grins and all of that. You could say there's a very patronizing aspect to, you know, the script she was given and the function that she was called on to perform here.
Yeah. I mean, her main goal is to get intelligence work for him. She's giving him information on these guys.
Right, but she's so ditzy and just kind of so, you know, that it's just kind of like, give me a break, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, he crucially needs her to make a phone call in this, and I kind of wondered why he couldn't find any other person on the planet who could make that phone call.
Yeah. She's quite hampered when it comes down time to deliver. You know, and it's even interesting. I mean, I put the poster up, an original 1971 poster, an illustrated rendition of both her and Warren Beatty, and it is kind of interesting the way they're both kind of cartoonishly portrayed here. And her eyes are like almost like scary, and how big and blue, and, you know, the eyelashes, the mascara and all of that. It's really kind of, you know, cartoonish and a little bit, you know, unsettling just how she's portrayed. And it's kind of like, I guess, her laughing character, except they're trying to make her into a real whole person, which isn't an entirely successful attempt, but it is what it is.
Yeah. She was on a particular hot streak at this moment. Like, she is off her two, like Cactus Flower in another film that are really big hits. But apparently she said that she thought she was just lost in this film. Like,
yeah,
she didn't say why, but that she didn't think she did a very good job. And,
well, I don't know that she was given a lot to work with. She was just kind of boopsy boo, and you know, even her function as a as a prostitute, or, you know, it doesn't seem very plausible. You know, I don't. No. Yeah.
Apparently, anyway. People pay large money for you to dress like a fireman.
Yeah. Yeah. Hit me with a seltzer bottle, baby. That's what I'm here for.
Kind of the red light district. I mean, the red light district in Hamburg, and I'm paying you to hit me with seltzer.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of the red light district, there certainly was a pretty generous slice of that. Some of the Reeperbahn landmarks, as well as the strip club, and a little gratuitous flesh peddling going on there. Yeah, again, part of the entertainment for men, which I think is kind of where this film was aiming, kind of the Esquire Playboy type crowd.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. It's it leans into that pretty heavily.
Yeah, yeah. But anyways, getting it back to the main heist action, you said you really enjoyed the cleverness. What are some of the aspects of the central job that jumped out at you?
Well, first of all, the basic idea, the phone call he wants Goldie Hawn to make is a bomb threat to the bank, and mm-hmm. he personally takes a gold bar that's on display in the bank and runs into the vault and locks himself in.
Yeah, and it's a pretty impressive chunk there, too. This isn't just a gold bar. Yeah. This is like a big, fat ingot there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is a ruse, because his real plan is that he's taking the money out of these three criminals' safe deposit boxes and transferring them into Goldie Hawn's safe deposit box.
And he's kept his association with her very separate from everybody at the bank so that they wouldn't know they had any kind of connection with each other.
So the idea is supposed to be nobody except these three criminals even know that any robbery took place, and because they're criminals, they can't tell anyone that their money's been stolen.
Exactly. So you get into the technical setup. He's got to have duplicate keys made for each of the safe deposit boxes. And these are kind of dual verifications. You've got one key held by the renter of the box, and another key held by a bank employee, so nobody could just walk in and open it by themselves. But, you know, you sort of see all that setup going on, where Warren Beatty's, you know, forging the keys himself, filing them down, getting the stopwatch so that he can kind of time when the camera is going to go back and forth as it pivots between two different parts of the vault. And so, yeah, there's just all that kind of you know, the mechanics of how this thing is set up, which is always a great source of appeal in these movies. You know, the ingenuity, the precision, the planning, the forethought, the contingencies you take so that when something goes wrong, here's how you're going to cover for that type of, you know, possibility. And so you see all of those things kind of unfolding over the course of, you know, the middle hour of the film. And it is. It's all, to me at least, and I think for a lot of other viewers, pretty entertaining stuff.
Yeah, he gets a lot of tension out of that sequence, partly mm-hmm. because he's got that 20-second stopwatch running so that he can mm-hmm. do things while the camera's not looking at him. And then, of course, not part of his plan, but Gert Frobe decides he has to get him out of the vault because he's locked himself into the vault. So they're going to burn a hole in the wall of the vault and give him the keys to get out. So he's got an extra time limit on him now.
Right, because he could be detected if he doesn't make the transfer of all those, all that cash and whatever other goods are in those boxes before he's rescued. And so, you know, the way the smoke plays into it, there's all that kind of, you know, tension and suspense that builds up as we see him, you know, executing the job. So yeah. The deed is done, and then we get to enjoy the burn of these three criminal enterprises all coming in to empty their box, only to find out that the box was already emptied prior to their arrival, and how they respond to that. And so so Las Vegas, basically, they just kind of melt away and decide that we've blown it. The mob's never going to believe us. We better go into hiding and, you know, run for our lives. And that's pretty much the end of it that you see from them. And then the army and the scary German guy, the Shades guy, they end up kind of getting together as they find that they're part of this drug smuggling operation. And that's where the final half hour of the film kind of erupts into this pretty vigorous and pretty exciting and very creative chase scene. Again, another, I've watched it a couple times and I found myself pretty engaged each time. In fact, I think this is a good take the time to watch it twice because, you know, the surprise and novelty of seeing the whole thing is great the first time around, and then re-experiencing how it's all planned and how it all comes together, to me it makes it very worthy of a second watch.
Yeah, I'm less of a fan of the movie after the heist.
Okay.
I think the chase is fine, but it goes on way longer than it should.
I don't know. This is a 2-hour movie. Probably an hour 45 would have been sufficient. Yeah.
It's good that they had a scene in it. I'm not even sure I understand why they had a scene in it, but they gave you a scene to show that Warren Beatty was in really good shape. Like he was doing the scene where they were testing.
Oh, breathing. Yeah. He's doing that kind of like a kind of bicycle thing.
Yeah.
He's in reclining on his back and working it pretty hard with breathing apparatus, right?
Because that at least makes it minimally plausible that he could run halfway across Germany carrying a suitcase with him the entire time.
You know, it is. I mean, it really is kind of ridiculous. And there is also the other element, which is, you know, they refuse. Both of the guys, I think, have guns as they're chasing Warren Beatty. And they're from, like, what, 20, 30 feet away? Sometimes they're almost, like, right up next to him, you know? But they choose not to shoot him because they're not sure if he really has the money. Well, why don't you just shoot the guy and then find out if he has the money? I mean, you're pretty deep into it at this point, you know. So,
I guess because they're thinking they could make him tell them where it is if it's not.
Yeah, I suppose, but it felt a little bit flimsy. I mean, even if you just shoot his legs out or something, just to, you know, catch the guy and find out what's going on. But because they are armed but choose not to use it. That stretches the pursuit on and on and on. I mean, it goes on for many, many miles. In fact, he gets into a truck. You know, he gets onto a car carrier. And the guy gets the license number and somehow traces the license number to find out where the truck landed, you know, presumably many, many miles away. Because now we're up into snowy territory and that must have been up in the Alps or something. So, it's just, I guess he's just got to suspend disbelief and let the story go where it does. But I did enjoy those sequences, the chase scene out on the icy, frozen lake there. You knew where that was going to go pretty much as soon as the car went out on the ice. Yeah. But it was fun. It was pretty well crafted, and I was happy to be along for the ride.
Yeah, there's not like anything in particular I dislike in that sequence.
Yeah.
The long chase, it just feels like maybe we could have like 20 minutes less of it.
Yeah. No, I think there's plenty of room for trimming, you know, portions out of each of those little sequences because, you know, there are some bits that just kind of do feel like padding, but you know, Richard Brooks wanted to do it the way he did, I guess. And there we go. We got a 2-hour movie out of it.
I also question, there's a major plot point. The major reason that they figure out who robbed them is that Scott Brady, like the army guy, keeps a framed picture of him and a prostitute in his office, which feels less than plausible.
Yeah, you don't really want to put your tracks out there that obviously, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, anyways, these are fun films, and again, the surveillance technology, a little bit more of that cheerful, grim wantonness of it. I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. There's a little bit of reveling in the kind of gritty and grimy side of things without feeling the need to socially redeem your message or to try to, you know, legitimize it through making some kind of a more noble political statement or cultural criticism. It's just, you know, life can be kind of harsh and shitty sometimes. And here are some sort of exaggerated examples of how it can go. I mean, yeah, there's definitely some brutality going on in each of these films that, you know, taps into a certain early 70s ethos. You kind of mentioned the Watergate era, the paranoia, the kind of recognition that the powers that are running the show are not to be trusted, and that they often have very dirty motives as far as the common folks of the world are concerned.
Yeah, I think Beatty gets a notable speech in this that sort of gives that, where Goldie Hawn speaks of these guys as her customers, and she says, you know, no, you work for them. Everybody works for them. These mm-hmm. people who make all this money on the side, they run everything.
Yeah.
And it feels very early 70s and not very late 60s.
Right. And it's interesting to think about, you know, Warren Beatty, even though he was a pretty big star, I think he was fairly selective about the movies he made. So there had to be something here that attracted him to the project. And as I understand it, Dollars was not really very successful financially. It didn't seem to connect. I think even the Anderson tapes might have been more of a hit than this one was, although I would say I think Dollars is the more, you know, substantial and engaging film, despite some of the flaws that we've already described about it. I mean, would you put one over the other in terms of your own kind of favoring?
I think the Anderson tapes is more consistent for me, but I do mm-hmm. agree it's a less engaging film in that the robbery is kind of perfunctory. Well, in this one, I mean, if a heist film is largely about the heist in Dollars is very memorable.
Yeah, yeah.
And the atmosphere, I mean, the German atmosphere of it is a little bit more interesting than...
Yeah, Central Park, New York City, yeah. All that. Yeah, yeah.
I did notice Goldie Hawn said that there was the thought that Dollars was a surefire hit because Brooks was hot and Beatty was hot and she was hot and she doesn't know why, it just didn't click with people.
Maybe because they didn't have a real title for the film, just the dollar symbol.
Yes, yeah.
Well, and you know, I don't know. I mean, we kind of made light of it already, but I think the finale. I mean, the sergeant army guy overdosing on a swig of LSD out of a champagne bottle. I'm not sure that's really what would have happened.
Goes down pretty quick.
It sure does. It's like, no, I think his brain would be a little bit, you know, in for it, but it would be a little slower onset than what we see on screen. I think it was, I mean, I don't know what Richard Brooks's views on psychedelia were, but you know, it feels to me like he didn't really know what he was dealing with there, because it's not the kind of thing that's gonna, you know, fry your brain instantly. He's playing more off of the popular stereotype of you know, people thinking they can fly and jumping out of windows or something like that. Or the way they fit it to the cat earlier in the film, and then the cat just kind of freaks out and, you know.
I was going to say, yeah. I think they think the scene with the cat justifies it. But
yeah.
That's a cat. I kind of buy it in that case, but I don't know that Scott Brady's just going to go down like a sack of potatoes.
Like he's just swallowed cyanide or something like that.
Yeah. He's Lawrence Tierney's brother, by the way.
I did not know that.
Okay. Yeah, it's not many people do, because he chose a completely different stage name. But if you look at the two of them side by side, you'll notice they look almost identical.
Fascinating. All right. Well, any last bits here before we wrap this up? I think we've had a pretty nice conversation about it. I would definitely recommend these. And again, going back to the Quincy Jones theme, this one does have a pretty cool soundtrack. Little Richard makes a couple of appearances, and they definitely, you know, give Little Richard his prominence and his due. Fun times. This is a nice little, whether you want to call it a Saturday matinee or just kind of a little popcorn flick or just something to pass the time without having to be, you know, too majorly challenged in the intellectual capacity or thematic elements. I enjoyed this little detour here.
Yeah. I think both are very fun, and they're interesting in kind of a metatextual way, but not not heavy lifting.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. Yeah, and again, just to get into that early 70s vibe, I think you've got some very interesting cultural artifacts here, and that's one of the things I really love about watching movies from this era. So, Richard, thank you for hanging in there with me and talking about these films. Any last words you want to put out there before we wrap it up?
No, just watch the films, man.
Okay, cool. And of course, we're talking from in the midst of the pandemic, so we do encourage everybody to stay safe, stay healthy, and be well. We'll be coming back at you soon. My next episode is going to be WR, Mysteries of the Organism, a pretty great film by Dusan Makaviev, based on the work of Wilhelm Reich, and I'm really eager to get into some crazy Yugoslavian subversive counterculture wildness. So that's what's coming up next here on Criterion Reflections. Thank you for listening, and everybody, we'll be talking to you real soon. Bye-bye. Make